Glad you're with us this evening, and we're continuing on looking at our material on David. As you can see, David, and there's just so many things that we can do about David. No, but there was an outstanding case in a small western mining town. Joe was brought before the court and on an assault charge, and the state presented the weapons that he used. He used a huge telegraph pole, a dagger, a pair of shears, a saw, a gun, and a Civil War saber. Now the counsel for the defense produced the weapons used by the alleged victim to defend himself. He had a scythe, a hoe, an axe, a shovel, and a pair of tongs. And after deliberating for a little while, the 12 men of the jury filed in, and the foreman read the verdict. "We, the jury, would give $500 to see the fight." Well, those kind of weapons, I think so too, wouldn't you? But that, you know, that's the way I feel about this story about David and Goliath. I would almost give anything to go back in time so I could see what happened and how it occurred. You know, we know by reading the pages, but I'd like to see it visually and see how that became a part of our figure of speech. Anytime that someone takes on someone, it seems like a little guy takes on a big guy, or a little corporation, or a small businessman takes on a larger one. We're always talking about the David and Goliath. And so that's the comparison that has come into our everyday language all the time. You know, and what are some of the giants, of course, that threaten us? I suppose a close parallel would be a person, of course, that we confront, that we have to deal with. A giant could be a series of unfortunate events like what Job was faced with when he lost his health and his wealth and his family all over just a few days' time. A giant could be a severe test, such as what Jesus went through in the wilderness. Paul writes in Ephesians for Christians to prepare themselves for when the day of evil comes. And so a giant can be a financial challenge that becomes a setback for us. But the lessons and things that we're going to learn here this evening are going to be drawn from David and Goliath. But I think they're applicable to various scenarios in our own lives, and will help us face whatever kinds of giants that we are facing both today and in the future. And as we noted, as we'll note here, there are three characteristics of a giant killer this evening. And as you can see, this is part one. Next week we'll obviously have part two. That we like to follow them in that order, one and two, so yeah, we can keep them in some kind of continuity. But there are three things we want to note here this evening. The first one is, the giant killers do the right thing now. Here's the scripture we're looking at in relationship to this, 1 Samuel 17, verse 11. On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. And there's 1 Samuel 17, 15. But David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. Now David went back and forth, it says here, and he is tending the flock. And in the meantime, he also was playing the harp for King Saul. You know, if you ever heard, I saw that little bit of that comedy sketch, and I won't go do the whole thing, but it was, you know, come on and play on your harp here, little David. And so that's what he was doing for Saul, and David was going down to see how his brothers were doing down at the battle. You know, it reminds me a lot of during the Civil War days, or the war between the states, or whatever you want to call it, that when there were some conflicts, people actually got into their buggies and went out and sat on ridges and watched the actual battle. You know? And now we can sit at home and run the remote and watch the same thing, can't we? But he was, and sometimes when you're running the remote, you have an actual battle in the house anyway, don't you, as to what you're going to be watching. But he was taking these supplies from his father on down there to his brothers. And what he observes is what had been happening every day there for a month. Each morning, all of Israel's army would get up, they'd put on their armor, they'd get on all their battle gear together here, and then they'd shout, "Charge!" And then they'd go back into their tents and they'd stay. You know, it was like a football team that would go out and take the field and we'll go through all the warm-ups on the field. And then they go over the sidelines and they would knock each other around, you know. And then when the game was ready to begin, they'd all run back into the locker room. Well, that was Israel. And that was what was going on here. And note that by this time in his young life, David had already mastered the basics. You know, he had learned faithfulness in the small. The unglamorous tasks, of course, of things that he'd been given, he had done them faithfully. He had learned obedience to his father. And as he was going back and forth, and as he was doing the sheep, he had learned responsibility then for the sheep, because of many of the time he was out there by himself and he had to make decisions about those sheep when he was out there. He had learned service, of course, and ferrying supplies back and forth from his father to his brothers during all this. And in addition, because we know David, we know that while he was living out long, lonely stretches in the hills, shepherding the sheep, he was praying and he was worshiping the Lord. You know, he was writing these passionate prayers and these worship songs called the Psalms. He was meditating constantly upon the Word of God. And all these practices served to build an inner core of faith and strength and courage into David. He had become a reliable man. You know, someone that you could count on to get the job done. Even if it was a dirty job, as shepherding was, you could count on David. And so David was doing what he was supposed to be doing. He was obeying his father. He was watching the sheep. He was carrying supplies to his brothers. Before he ever faced a giant, he was faithful in the small things. David did the right thing now. Now, on the army, on the other hand, Israel's army, was unfaithful in their task in going to war. You know, they were afraid of the giant, and unlike David, had not paid the price to master the basics of faithfulness, obedience, responsibility, service, and trust. They had the outer armor, but they did not have that inner core. You see, and as a result, we see a picture of David doing what he is supposed to do, but the army not doing what they're supposed to do. Now, giant killers have spent their lives doing the right thing. In the process, they have developed this inner core of faith and strength and courage. And where does that come from? You know, Philip Brooks wrote it this way. He said, someday in the years to come, you'll be wrestling with the great temptation or trembling under the great sorrow of your life. But the real struggle is here, now. Now it is being decided whether in the day of your supreme sorrow or temptation you should miserably fail or gloriously conquer. Character cannot be made except a steady, long, continued process. Character happens over time. It just doesn't magically happen when you're faced with your first giant. Now, a sports recruiter for a college was interviewing a star high school athlete, and he asked the boy, he says, "Can you run?" And he said, "Sure I can. I ran the mile under 4 minutes twice last year." Then he asked him, "How about your kicking game?" "Ah, 36 extra points without a block." And then he said, "Oh, he's getting really into this." And then he says, "You know, I can also tackle, and I can run the ball good as well." And of course, the college recruiter, he's getting all excited. And he says, "Well," he says, "son, do you have any weaknesses at all?" And there was this pause, and then the boy answered, "Well, I do have a tendency to stretch the truth a bit. I'm not sure about his scholarship at that point. But, you know, on Giant Killing Day, it's going to be real clear whether we stretched the truth or we paid the price to develop that inner core that we need to overcome. Everyone, wants to win on Saturday afternoon, but the guys who are the ones that win are the ones that practice during the week. You know, Roger Staubach, the Hall of Fame quarterback, said it takes a lot of unspectacular preparation to produce spectacular results. You know, private victories lead to public ones. And doing the right things now develops our inner core of strength and courage and faith. First, there are the spiritual disciplines that we need to master in our lives, which include spending dedicated time daily with God in prayer, time in Bible study. Secondly, there is the time we need to have of regular worship in church. And thirdly, we need to perform ministry and service. And fourthly, then, we need to give money for the work of the kingdom of God. And aside from the spiritual disciplines, doing the right thing now includes getting up and going to work, spending quality time with our spouses and our children and grandchildren, obeying the law, paying our taxes, being a good neighbor, being a good citizen. A second thing here is that giant killers see the reward. 1 Samuel 17:25 through 27 says the king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel. David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and removes the disgrace from Israel?" Now David overhears the soldiers talking about the reward that everyone's going to get, or anyone can get, if they would go and kill Goliath. You know, the reward was threefold. First, he's going to get a lot of money. Second, he would win the hand of the princes in marriage here. And thirdly, and probably most important, his family would be tax-exempt for life. Boy, and all you people that done your taxes here this in the last few months are still dangling with them. Wouldn't that be nice? Tax-exempt for life. I mean, David's response was to say, "Excuse me. You know, I thought I heard you say that the man who kills Goliath is going to get a lot of money, marry the king's daughter, and live tax-free for the rest of his life." "And that's right," they said. And he responded, "Well, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Now, I don't mean to imply that David was materialistic, that he was just in it for the money, but clearly he was interested in the reward. You know, and folks, there's nothing wrong with that. Did the army of Israel know about the reward for killing Goliath? Yes. They're the ones who told David about it. But the army saw Goliath while David saw God. The army saw a problem and David saw potential. The army thought, what good is a lot of money, a royal marriage, and tax exemption if you're not alive to enjoy them? You know, it reminds me of a story I heard about a wealthy Texas oil baron. He invited the most eligible bachelors in Dallas over to his house for a barbecue. And as they were standing at one end of his Olympic-sized swimming pool, he issued this following challenge. He said, "Men, I have filled the pool with gators and crocs and poisonous snakes and piranha and snapping turtles. To the first man who is brave enough to jump in and swim all the way to the other side and climb out alive, I will give him the choice of $1 million, 10,000 acres of my oil land, or my daughter's hand in marriage." Barely had he finished speaking when there was this splash, and the astonished crowd watched as this singular man swam the length of the pool and he jumped out the other side. And the oil baron said, he says, "You did it." You know? He says, "You went over the gators. You went under the crocs. You went around the snakes. You went through the piranhas. You went past the snapping turtles. You did it. Now, what is it that you want here? He says, do you want the $1 million? Do you want the 10,000 acres of oil land? Do you want my daughter's hand in marriage? And he said to him, he says, I want the name of the guy that pushed me into the swimming pool. This is a critical characteristic of a giant killer. Instead of focusing on all the negative fallout of facing up to the giant, we focus here on the reward. You know, folks, we're already facing negative fallout with a giant. The giant is not going away. You know, the giant had already been there for 40 years. He was not going, or 40 days, he was not going away. And he was just going to get bigger, and he was going to get worse. But if we face the giant, and sure it's risky, but God says we will hit a bigger spiritual and emotional jackpot than we ever imagined possible. You know, a story was told to me, in fact, last night. A young lady had just gotten her, had her 16th birthday, gotten her license, had them for about 2 weeks, and she got pulled over for speeding. And she knew that her dad would have a fit. And so she waited a week before she told him about it. And then she was that week that was happening was a week away at a conference where other young people her age was. And she just couldn't enjoy her week because she knew somewhere, probably at the end of that week, after that week was over, she's going to have to tell her dad. And she just could not enjoy the week because she knew what lay in her future. It was her giant. And she said, I told my dad, and he said, oh, shrugged his shoulders, and on he went. She could have slain that giant at the beginning of the week and enjoyed the whole thing, you see. In Randy Alcorn's book, The Treasure Principle, he mentioned the example of the missionary to Ecuador, Jim Elliot. Some of you may be familiar with his story and heard it. Elliot wrote in his journal, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. And if we hear those words and think, oh, he was just one of those super spiritual missionary types who didn't think about gain, well, then we miss the whole point here, of course. We read it again, and it says, you know, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose. And gain was precisely, of course, what Jim Elliot was thinking about. He just wanted the kind of gain that he couldn't lose. And, oh, you shouldn't talk about rewards. You shouldn't talk or even think about rewards. You shouldn't be motivated by rewards. Why not? Jesus talked about rewards all the time. In fact, he said, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Yeah. Ever seen that bumper sticker that says, he who dies with the most toys wins? And, you know, millions of people act as if that is true, you know. The more accurate saying is that he who dies with the most toys still dies. You know, and he never takes his toys with him. When we die after devoting our lives to acquiring things, we don't win. We lose. Our toys stay behind and they fill the junkyards, and people will have yard sales and garage sales and all sorts of stuff, and nameless people will come along and purchase the things that we have been trying to acquire all of our lives and take them over to their house so that their family can do the same thing one day when they die. Now, is that the type of things that we like to acquire in this life? Or do we want to acquire things that we can't lose? Kill the giant. Win the reward. Third, giant killer, shake off the critics. Someone has said you can determine the caliber of a person by the amount of opposition that it takes to discourage them. You know, some critics in our lives are constructive. They love us and are out to help us. But this account illustrates three types of critics that we need to shake off in order to be giant killers. And one of them is his own brother here, Eliab. Notice this passage, 1 Samuel 17, 28-29. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, "Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle." Now what have I done?" said David. "Can't I even speak?" Now, Eliab, of course, represents critics who are over us emotionally. You know, Eliab was David's older brother. In the family, there's something about an older brother or an older sibling that is emotionally dominant over his siblings. And you know, they're bigger, they're the first child, they're first to receive authority and responsibility. I know, you know, I'm an older child. I'm an older brother. Now, Eliab criticized David's motives. He called him conceited and wicked and suggesting that he just wanted to come out and see the fight. And Eliab was always criticizing David. And how do we know that? We know because of David's response. He said, "What have I done now?" No, with Eliab who questions our motives, there's often sometimes something deeper behind those criticisms themselves. Eliab's problem may have been that he was passed over by Samuel to be the next king over Israel. After all, he was the taller, the better looking, the one that looked kingly. And he was passed over. And he knew that the oil had run down on the head of David. And it might have been something that he just could not handle at this point. But the second critic here is Saul. 1 Samuel 17:33, Saul replied, "You are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You're only a boy, and he has been a fighting man from his youth." Now, Saul represents those critics, of course, that have a high position or a higher position over us. You know, Saul was the king. You would think that if anyone was going to get excited about taking out the giant, it would be the king. And it's obvious Saul's not going to do it. However, when the person in a position of leadership is a petty, jealous person, he will look at others in his organization as a threat instead of a help. A critic is one who points out how imperfectly other people do what the critic won't do himself. When it comes to the criticism of those who aren't even in the game, we need to just shake it off. Now, a third critic here that we see was Goliath himself. 1 Samuel 17:43 and 44, he said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." And Goliath represents the critic who are over us in ability. You know, as a bystander watching this matchup, we would have to bet on Goliath. He is head over heels better than David in ability. Goliath despised David's ability, but the world is full of talented, charismatic, and gifted derelicts. Now, I have watched time and time again when someone has come into the major leagues, for instance, with all this type of potential. They say, "This guy's got this talent, and he's going to be..." And you know, he's been lazy. He had enough natural talent to make it to the major leagues, but if he would have exercised himself a little more, practiced a little more, done a little more, he could have done more. He could have gone farther, but he failed his potential. You know, history shows that attitude, courage, persistence, and faith trump ability. When it comes to the criticism of Goliath, we need to shake it off. A man was getting a haircut prior to a trip to Rome, and he mentioned the trip to the barber, who responded, "Rome? You know, why would anyone want to go to Rome? Why go there? You know, it's crowded, it's dirty, it's full of Italians. You know, you're just crazy to go to Rome. So how you going on there?" And he mentioned the airline that he was taking, and he said, "Well, that's the worst airline." He says, "Yeah, but we got a great rate." "I don't care," he says. "It's a terrible airline. The planes are old. Their flight attendants are rude, and they're always late. So where are you staying in Rome?" "Oh, we'll be at the Downtown International Marriott." "That dump? That's the worst hotel in the city. The rooms are small, the service is surly, and they're overpriced. So what are you going to do when you get there?" "Oh, we're going to go see the Vatican. We hope to see the Pope." "That's rich," he said. "You and a million other people will be trying to see him. And he'll look you'll look like the size of an ant to him. And boy, good luck on that lousy trip of yours. You know, you're going to need it." And so a month later, he comes back into the barbershop for his regular haircut. And the barber asked him, "Well, on that trip just the way I told you?" He said, "No, not at all." He says, "In fact, the airline was wonderful. They had brand new planes, and they had overbooked, and so they pushed us up into first class. And I had a beautiful 28-year-old stewardess who waited on me hand and foot. And the hotel, it was great. When we got there, they had just done a $25 million renovation on it. And it was the finest hotel in the city, but they too were overbooked. And so they apologized and they gave us the presidential suite at no extra charge." "Well," said the barber, I know you didn't get to see the Pope." "It's actually, we were quite lucky. For as we turned the Vatican, a Swiss guard tapped me on the shoulder and explained the Pope would like to personally meet with some of the visitors. And if I'd be so kind as to step in the private room and wait, the Pope would personally greet me." And sure enough, 5 minutes later, the Pope walked through the door. He shook my hand. I knelt down and he spoke to me. And the barber says, "Really? What did he say?" And he said, "Where'd you get that lousy haircut?" Critics create solution pollution. Every person who has never killed a giant will say that it's impossible. Don't wait for the approval of the critics. Raise the bar. You know, strive for a level of excellence that others can't be bothered with. In our personal growth, our work, our family, and our relationship with God, and in our church, we don't cater to the critics. They won't like it, but we can do it anyway because God gives us permission.